And we're recording. Okay, this is Lila, and I'm recording with Dr. Crosby for the derm site. All right, so let's go ahead and start talking about Mohs surgery.
Sure. Mohs surgery is a highly specialized skin cancer surgery that allows us to remove skin cancer with a really high degree of precision and also leave behind the smallest scar. And so, like I said, you know, that's kind of the end of the spiel. How long should I go? You know, what's
I should have said up front. We need about three to five minutes of content.
3 to 5 sentences per. Okay.
Okay, so let's go ahead and start that over. I'm actually going to set a stopwatch so that it's a little easier for me to know whether I need to prompt you a follow-up question. Please give me 1 second there, and I'll restart it. Okay, let's go ahead and start talking about Mohs.
Sure. Mohs surgery is a highly specialized surgery that we use for the treatment of certain types of skin cancer. It allows us to treat the skin cancer, remove the skin cancer, and with a high degree of certainty, and have a very high cure rate, well above 95%, and also allows us to leave behind the smallest scar so that we can treat the skin cancer and prevent any sort of deformity. That's kind of the bullet, you know, without questions that, I mean, there's a lot more I can say, but.
Compare Mohs skin cancer surgery to other forms of treating skin cancer.
Sure. There are many types of ways that we treat skin cancer. The three most common ways that we treat skin cancer are using standard excisions, radiation, or Mohs surgery. And they all have their pluses and minuses. Standard excision is a very good option for a large number of skin cancers. It's where we look at the skin cancer, measure a standard margin around the skin cancer based on research, and remove that. It has a very high cure rate, and it's very good for areas where we're not too concerned about scarring. Example of one of those areas might be on the back or the lower or the thigh, areas where you have some extra skin, and taking a little bit more to have a high cure rate may not be a problem. Radiation can also be good treatment for skin cancer. The problem with radiation is its cure rate's not quite as high. It tends to have a large number of treatments, anywhere from 8 to 10 treatments. And it's a good option for patients that for some reason can't tolerate surgery, just do not want surgery, or sometimes patients may have other medical comorbidities that may make surgery difficult or not the best option. And then that leaves Mohs surgery, which is really usually the best treatment for skin cancers that occur on their head or neck, because these are areas that are very cosmetically sensitive. And it's also very useful for other areas of the body when the skin cancer may be very large or very long-standing, or it may be a complex skin cancer that has come back after other treatments, or in patients that have other diseases that make skin cancer more aggressive.
What types of skin cancer can you treat with Mohs?
So you can really treat all the most common skin cancers with Mohs surgery. The most common skin cancer is basal cell carcinoma. The three most common are basal cell carcinoma, squamous cell carcinoma, and melanoma. And these actually can all be treated with Mohs surgery. There are a number of other skin cancers that people don't really hear about so often that are more rare. Some of them can even be a little bit more aggressive than melanoma. And those also have very high cure rates when they're treated with Mohs surgery. So really any skin cancer is a candidate for Mohs surgery in the proper hands.
Okay, tell me a little bit more about the Mohs surgery process. How long does it take, and what is the downtime, et cetera?
Sure. Well, Mohs surgery, we always tell our patients to really plan on being in the clinic for most of the day. It doesn't usually take quite that long, but it is a process that has some areas that are a little bit unpredictable. The way it works is you'll come into the clinic, and typically you've had a consultation with me before the procedure, so we've told you what to bring and how to prepare. And so you come into the clinic for the day of your procedure. We verify the location in our medical record. We give you a mirror to make sure that you know where the spot is, I look in my records and we make sure we're all on the same page. It's a very important first step. And then we'll get the area anesthetized. We use local anesthesia, and you're awake throughout the entire procedure. So we numb the area. I take just a bit of skin, just around what I can see with the naked eye of the skin cancer. And that tissue is taken just down the hall to our histotechnician, and it's frozen, sliced very thin, made into slides, and look at those slides under the microscope to determine the margins and whether or not we need to take more. So that initial step, taking the skin, takes maybe 10 minutes or so. Then the preparation of the slides maybe takes 30 or 45 minutes, and it takes me some time to read the slides. So at that point, it's about an hour. And if everything is clear after that first stage, we can proceed to the repair and get things back to normal. If we find that there's more skin cancer, then we have to take a little bit more, and that cycle is repeated. So you can see, based on how much skin cancer we find or whether we find any additional skin cancer, the length of the day can be longer. Probably the minimum is maybe 2 hours. Occasionally, very rarely, with very large skin cancers, it may even actually stretch over 1 or 2 days. It just really depends on the size. But there is some variability in how long the procedure takes.
Okay, perfect. And that takes care of Mohs. That gave us plenty of content. So next, we will be talking about skin cancer. Okay. Start by telling me the different types of skin cancers.
Sure. So there are many, many types of skin cancers. The three most common that most people have heard of are basal cell carcinoma, squamous cell carcinoma, and melanoma. Basal cell carcinoma is by far the most common, and it tends to be the least aggressive. Basal cell carcinomas tend to grow relatively slowly. They can, however, start to destroy tissue or vital structures as they approach those areas. So you can imagine a basal cell carcinoma on the back could potentially grow a little bit larger before it started to damage things, as opposed to one on the eyelid, where it could really start to impact the eye or impact your vision. Squamous cell carcinoma is the second most common type, and it is a little bit more variable in how aggressive it can be. Many times in otherwise healthy patients, squamous cell carcinomas tend to behave almost similarly to basal cell carcinoma and can be easily treated. In some patients, especially patients with immune compromise, whether they may have a blood disorder or even more typically transplant patients, squamous cell carcinomas can actually grow very rapidly, spread to other parts of the body, and become life-threatening. So it's very important to treat them in those scenarios. The third type of, most common type of skin cancer, melanoma, is one that can definitely be more aggressive. It has more of a tendency to spread, to leave the skin and spread to other parts of the body, such as the brain and the lung. And really how the potential for spread is really based on how early it's diagnosed. And so melanoma that's diagnosed very early tends to have an extremely high cure rate, well above 90%, as it has time to invade deeper into the skin and has that increased potential for spread, the cure rates drop very substantially. And so with all these skin cancers, especially with melanoma, the most important thing is that we are able to diagnose and treat the lesions early.
Okay, when it comes to diagnosing early, what do you recommend as far as self-checks? How often should they come in and see a dermatologist to have their skin checked for cancers, et cetera?
Sure. At home, self-checks are important, and I always recommend my patients, especially have a lot of moles, to perhaps pick a time of the month where you check yourself front and back in the mirror, or have your spouse or partner help you with that. And it's best to do it not usually every single day, because we know if you look at something every single day, you really have less of a tendency to notice subtle changes. And so you want to pick a time that's spread out a little bit. So once a month is typically very good. If you notice any particular changes that are concerning, those are things that you bring to the attention of your physician or general physician or dermatologist. And as far as having a dermatologist check, an annual check, if you have really no other risk factors, you've not had any skin cancers before, then an annual check is fine. And at that annual check, your physician will take a look at all of your moles or any spot that you may have been concerned about since your last visit, and determine whether or not they need to be biopsied or treated further. Anyone that has had skin cancer, that has a strong family history of skin cancer, especially first-degree relatives like brothers or parents or sisters, then you want to have a skin check with a dermatologist at least twice a year.
Okay, and what about preventative measures? Sunscreen, of course, year-round, but what SPF and what else do you recommend as far as preventing sun damage?
The most important modifiable, or the most important thing that we can control about our skin cancer risk, is controlling our sun exposure. There are, of course, genetic components and other factors, but those are somewhat out of our control. So the thing that we can do to lower our skin cancer risk is to control the sun exposure. And there are a number of ways to do that. The easy and simple way is using a daily sunscreen. And we want to use a sunscreen of at least an SPF 30. The SPFs that are much higher than that, when you get up to an SPF 100, you're not necessarily getting twice or three times the protection. You're getting a little bit longer protection. So that could be important if you're going to be at the beach or hiking, where you're not really able to reapply as often as you should. But at least an SPF 30 with a for daily use is very good. One of the best ways to incorporate that is to find a facial moisturizer that has an SPF 30 in it. Many of the makeups that people use tend to have an SPF 15 or 20, which is not quite enough. And so you want to maybe find a moisturizer that can incorporate that SPF 30, work into your daily routine, and that makes it pretty easy.
Okay, when talking about sunscreen, what about brand? I know I've read articles where it says that some sunscreens are not as potent as they claim to be.
Sure. So the brand of sunscreen is probably not the most important. The most important thing is finding a product that is easy and convenient for you to use. And so there are a number of categories of sunscreen. We have what are called the physical blockers and the chemical blockers. The physical blockers are the ones that that have the kind of paint names like zinc oxide or titanium dioxide. And they actually have a pigment that physically blocks the sun from getting to your skin. They can be anywhere from completely pasty white, or they have fancy formulations where they grind the materials very small. And so they just have maybe a light bluish tinge, and some of them almost no tinge at all. So those sunscreens are good for patients that perhaps want to avoid chemicals or lots of chemicals, or that may have very sensitive skin. And those physical blockers are very good. The chemical blockers tend to be a little bit more water resistant. They tend to bind to the skin. They're not waterproof, so you still need to reapply them often. And they tend to be a little bit more cosmetically elegant, whereas the physical blockers, even the best ones, do tend to have somewhat of a cast or a tinge on the skin. The chemical blockers can be very elegant and be completely transparent. So the brands, you know, there are many different brands, there are many different price points, and there is some variability amongst brands as far as the SPF. If you would do a test, the one may be 5 or so plus or minus what the state SPF is, but they're not dramatic differences. And finding one that you can use is the most important thing, because if you have the best sunscreen, the SPF 100, the most expensive, elegant brand, and it's still in your purse or in your car and not on your skin, it's not doing you any good.
Okay, perfect. So let's talk about laser resurfacing.
Mm-hmm. Laser resurfacing, and there are a number of types of laser resurfacing, allows us to correct many aspects of the skin that concern people. My patients are oftentimes concerned about the discoloration that develops over time and with sun exposure, concerned about fine lines and wrinkles that develop over time and with sun exposure. And laser resurfacing, depending on the type of device that we use, really allow us to address almost all of those concerns very, very well.
Okay, who's a good candidate for laser resurfacing?
Candidate for laser resurfacing, let me start that one again. Most patients can be treated with laser resurfacing. The type of laser that we use and what we can treat does vary somewhat based on skin type. Typically, patients with more fair skin can tolerate more aggressive procedures. When we use laser resurfacing, we have to be very careful about creating pigment abnormalities. So patients that have a lot of pigment or darker skin type, we have to be more gentle. Sometimes we use different devices that don't damage the pigment as much. So really everyone is a candidate for laser resurfacing as long as we are using the right type of device and the right type of protocol for that.
What can be achieved with laser resurfacing?
Again, what can be, you know, laser resurfacing is in general a broad term. The things that can be achieved are dramatic improvements in skin tone, removing or improving dark spots, discoloration in the skin, dramatically improving fine lines and wrinkles in the skin. And so those are really the things that we are trying to address with resurfacing. That tone, the pigment problems, the hyperpigmentation and discoloration, and improving the fine lines and wrinkles and the texture of the skin.
What areas of the body can you treat?
We typically do laser resurfacing on the face. The face tends to respond very well, and it tends to have a very low rate of scarring. There are some laser resurfacing procedures that we can do on the chest, the décolletage, or the hands to get rid of some of the brown spots. We tend to be less aggressive on those areas because they're at a slightly higher risk of scarring. So for the head and neck, and mostly the chin and higher, that skin really responds very well. We can be a little bit more aggressive and have very, very good results. On the chest and arms, these other areas where people tend to have sunspots, we can use laser resurfacing, but we tend to use more gentle devices, more gentle settings, and we want to avoid any side effects from that.
Okay. We need about another minute's worth of audio. Do you have anything else to add on laser resurfacing?
Laser resurfacing. Another common problem that we treat with laser resurfacing is improving scars. So people have scars for many reasons, whether they've had an accident, they may have scars from other surgical procedures, they may have scars from acne. Acne scarring is a very large problem that I see in the practice. And laser resurfacing is extremely valuable in improving those scars, especially acne scarring. We can get dramatic improvements with the type of pitted acne scars that patients have on their foreheads and cheeks after having a history of severe acne. It can certainly improve the types of stretch marks that patients get, whether they've gained or lost significant amounts of weight, post-pregnancy, or perhaps bodybuilders, people that have changed their musculature, developed these stretch marks, and we can get improvements in the appearance of stretch marks with certain forms of laser resurfacing as well. The other types of scars patients tend to have are keloid scars, and these are scars that have increased in size from relatively minor injuries sometimes, and we can use laser resurfacing to flatten or improve the texture and appearance of these scars.
Okay, what kind of treatments is laser resurfacing often used along with, in conjunction with?
So the laser resurfacing oftentimes can be used in conjunction with other cosmetic treatments as well. So when we're looking at the cosmetic concerns that my patients have, oftentimes they're concerned about texture, they're concerned about fine lines and wrinkles, and they may be concerned about more significant wrinkles. Oftentimes they may be concerned about redness or broken blood vessels on the skin. So we can use laser resurfacing in conjunction with some of these other procedures. Many times we'll do Botox to help with some of the furrows that patients have around the forehead or the brow. We may use what's called a pulse dye laser or an IPL laser to address some of the redness in the face, and then use laser resurfacing to address the pigment and the fine lines and wrinkles that are left behind. So really, we have a number of cosmetic devices in the toolkit, and what it really boils down to is having the conversation with the patient, finding out what their concerns are, and then determining which devices, which products, which fillers, which other tools we have would be best suited to get them where they want to go.
Okay, perfect. And last question is sculpture.
Okay.
Let's talk about that.
Sure. Sculpture is a non-invasive body contouring device. And so what all those fancy words mean is it's a device that allows us to really help tone those those kind of stubborn bulges that patients have typically around the thighs, the arms, or the abdomen. And so it really kind of fills in that gap between diet and exercise and liposuction. So, you know, there are patients that may have areas where they've lost their weight, they still have this little stubborn and perhaps pocket around the belly, or it's just an area that they can't get rid of. And it's not quite, they're not really ready for an invasive procedure or surgical procedure such as liposuction. So this allows them to address those concerns in the office with no anesthesia in only about 25 minutes over a course of typically 3 treatments. And it's really, really for those small or stubborn pockets that can't be treated otherwise.
Okay, who would be a good candidate?
Typically, the person that's a great candidate for Sculpture is someone that is overall normal body weight to maybe slightly above normal body weight with stubborn areas of fat around the abdomen or thighs. So those are the patients that are looking to lose large quantities of weight or have large pockets of fat are not really candidates for this. That's more something that we should address with liposuction or some other procedure. But again, these are patients that are near ideal body weight, but just have stubborn areas that have not been able to be addressed.
Okay, what is the downtime after procedure? What can a patient expect?
The downtime after Sculpture is really zero. I've actually had the procedure done myself, and the procedure itself takes about 25 or 30 minutes. And afterwards, you really can get back to your normal activities. You patients do sometimes have a little bit of tenderness in the area. They may develop some small areas of firm tissue underneath as that fat is being broken down by the body naturally. But as far as getting back to normal activities afterwards, you can have the procedure, go back to work, go back and work out, and really do whatever you want to do. So there's very minimal to no downtime.
Okay, what about age restrictions?
Any adult is a candidate for Sculpture. It's not a procedure that was approved for use on children, and so we certainly don't treat children with the procedure. But any adult that's otherwise healthy is a candidate for the procedure. We have had patients that are in their 20s that want to tone some areas, and you know, there are patients in their 80s that still want to tone some areas, and so really age is not a limiting factor.
Okay. I think that'll be it enough. All right, so anything else that you want to share on Sculpture before I stop the recording?
No, I think that's good.
Okay.